unresolved incident, like really simple, just even something they saw half of on the train or the tram on the way to uni, or something big. Sometimes they write really big stuff, autobiographical stuff. And then I ask them to, we look at something in a story and then we go back and back. So we go back and I say, can you imagine someone else you know really well who wasn't there and put them there? And can you imagine writing that incident with an alternate ending which would feel more resolved to you? So we go back and
I thought you would have something better than that.
We can stop here before it ends. I wonder if anybody has any questions that they would like to ask. Yes, please.
Julia, do you mean in terms of practicing writing, it's not just about with the tennis analogy that you're using? Do you mean it's more not about just putting in the hours, but being a bit more consciously aware of how you're practicing your craft rather than just hitting the
owls
and hitting the
mm-hmm.
ball. Is that what you're trying
to say? I love that actually. One of my kids that says
they're
that.
They're taking pity on you, Julia.
It's a great question. When I try to explain something to my oldest daughter who's a nurse, she says to me, get there faster. So I do talk about that. It's a really good question. And here's the shortest answer. Bruce Pascoe, who's one of the biggest gems ever, I reckon, has been so gorgeous to me. And he says, tell it true. And so when I heckle with Luke about the tennis, I'm saying that to tell an individual story true, to tell that true, means that I can't necessarily take any other things because I'm listening to that subject matter. I don't know it and I don't know how to tell it. And Arnold's able, another way of showing this through someone else who will say it more clearly than I can. He came out and did a guest lecture for students and he said to them, do you ever think that something, do you ever forget that feeling that what you're writing is just weird? And we're all like, I'm like, yes. And he said, go there and trust, because he said inevitably in his work, the moments that he's second guessed and worried about other moments that readers have been drawn back to. And I have been stunned by that since in having work published, that the things that people come back and talk to you about, the things that you thought were maybe too boring or everyday or just simple behind closed doors, family moments, and the people are moved by them. So that's what I mean about telling it true and going there and not playing tennis.
Yeah. Okay.
There's more money for tennis though.
True.
Yes. I just keep thinking about it, something I heard John Marsden say to a big bunch of kids once about choosing words, the actual choice of the words that you want to put together to say the thing that you might have sort of kicked back ball and gone, that's what I'm going to say it. And then you go, hang on a minute, what actually do I want to say? And I just wondered, you know, those moments of the sentences in front of you, do you stop? Do you stop and think about your words? Or I'm interested in that idea, the choosing your words.
Yeah, I think that I love it when you write something and you're genuinely surprised by it, as if someone else, so when the voice comes, you know, that might be grammatically incorrect way of saying someone's dialogue or something, or those moments that stop you in your tracks. And if I'd thought about how to say that, I never would have written it like that, because it's wrong in a way, but it's so right for the character or the idea. Mm-hmm. So that's what I mean about Bruce Pascoe's advice, telling it true for me.
Yeah, definitely. Quite obsessively. I think that's the biggest thing, draw card to writing for me. I feel that language is always kind of kicking my ass, quite frankly. In real life, I'm never quite as articulate as I would like to be, and writing is a space where you can, level out the odds or something a bit more to your favour, because you've got more time and you can redraft it and all of that sort of thing. So, yeah, definitely I obsess over the way the words look on the page. That's the main motivator to try it. I think it was Ursula Le Guin who said that an artist is somebody who says what cannot be put into words, and a writer is an artist who puts in words what cannot be put in words.
Yeah.
And so that really resonates with me. Mm-hmm. Yes.
How often then do you go back and self-edit, do you do it while you're writing, or do you let the words get out on the page and then go back and go back?
For me, I mean, I don't think this is good advice, but I find it really hard to move on if I don't feel that the previous sentence I wrote was perfect and is never going to need changing. It, of course, that's never the case. I always go back and have to change it. But at the time, I need to feel like it was perfect. But the consequence or the result of that is I'm quite a slow writer and I don't get through a lot. And I have colleagues and peers who seem to write at extraordinary speeds to me and then take this great big thing that they finished and keep redrafting from there, whereas that idea kind of horrifies me. I'm not sure, it just doesn't, I mean, we were talking about writing last night and I'm quite interested in the metaphors that people have for writing, and my favourite metaphor, or the thing that comes closest to writing for me, is vacuuming. I get the same satisfaction out of vacuuming as I do out of writing, so it's very much about cleanliness and putting things
and
in order.
And I would say the opposite is true. So we were arguing about that. I've forgotten all about that. Heckling about that. So, yes, while I do a bit of that rewriting work, because you can't help it, you do a bit of not that word, this word, and then move on. But I think that it's true. The opposite is true for me. So I suggested that it's not about sucking in, which the vacuum does, cleaning up the mess, but it's about... spewing out, really. That's how I feel about that initial writing process, and I will often write the first draft. If it's working, I will write really urgently, and then the process of going back is something different altogether. And I love both processes, but that first one, when you're writing a new voice, actually it's exhausting. I find it exhausting, and I feel like you're sort of it's so spooky, and I don't sleep very well when I'm doing that. Mm. And my gorgeous Matthew says to me, How long do you think it will be this time? and then I come back, but so I do
normally, normally,
and I don't do any vacuuming.
how long on average would you be disappearing into your?
So if I had more time, if I didn't have a day job, a full time job with my family, I don't know, maybe it would be much shorter. But because I'm trying to find windows around that. So that the story that when I just wrote back to Light Play, I wrote back to that probably in over a period of 3 weeks. I'd get up at like 3 o'clock in the morning and go to work, write this voice. And then once I've got the voice, then I'll go back over a really long period of time and make it a story, because it's not a story, it's usually a mess.
Any other questions?
Yes, at what point does a short story become a novella or a novel, as in word count?
Oh, that's a good question, but I mean, people will argue with you forever.
I think the Griffith Review novella competition starts at 8,000 or something, which to me is very much a short story, certainly in the American tradition, but for their publication they're calling it a novella, so... those limits are not set in stone by any means, but when you're talking about the difference between novels, when they become books, when they become commodities, people expect a certain amount of bang for their buck. So you would have a hard time selling an 8,000 word novella for $30.
But then, some short story competitions you can submit up to 12,000, and some people would argue that's a novella. Mm. And then 60,000 words usually for a novel minimum. But a lot of people would consider that a slim novel too. So, yeah.
I did actually look that up before this session, and one of the sites that I found said technically a short story is anywhere between 1,000 and 20,000 words. If it's less than 1,000 words, it's considered flash fiction. And longer than 20,000 words, it's considered a novella. That kind of seems a bit too specific to me, but would that be about right?
I think 12 is a long short story, but I think up to 10 or 12 is still a short story. Mm. And I think, they're arbitrary rules, right? And even in the competitions that I manage and wrote the rules for, I did the same thing. I researched all around what does that actually mean. I mean, I think a lot of most short story competitions aim for this three. I don't know, but that's probably more about the pragmatics of judging because it's so time consuming. So I don't know that there's any fixed answer to that, to those questions. And who cares what anyone calls it anyway? You know what I mean?
Well, the writers of this festival cares.
I don't mean that.
The short story festival cares about you, Brittany.
I totally agree, but
who cares about the short story?
No, I totally care about the short story, but what I'm saying is some people would argue that this is a novel, and UWA would argue that it's a novel. And other people would argue that it's a fraction short story cycle, and it's both. And what I mean is that I don't care what anyone thought. Like, I don't care, because I'm glad it's published. I care if it's published. And apart from that, they're just kind of names. I think there's definitely a difference between a novel and a short story, but there's grey in between that.
We have time for one more question. Yes.
A question about endings, in particular, Julia, with your style, which I probably relate to more of kind of just writing and then sort of forming at some point into a story, but I do struggle with endings of short stories because I don't really work on a plot, you know, I don't have a beginning and a middle and an end, but when you read amazing short stories, sometimes they seem to just kind of end without a resolution, and others do seem to wrap up and have something to leave you with at the end. Do you guys feel there needs to be a kind of, I suppose, a structured ending?
I absolutely don't think there needs to be a structured ending. And I think I love open-ended endings. In fact, I would argue, like you, I can't really do endings very well. But I think when a story for me feels like it's finished, when I can leave it alone, it's when the imagery comes together in a particular way. And so it's a type of ending, even though it's an unfinished ending, that drawing together of the detail.
Yeah. Yeah, I think sort of endings in terms of plot are always going to be quite artificial because things don't end. So we sort of apply these structures onto a linear timeline and make it look like they come to an end, but they don't. So for me, an ending is probably something like that, when all the images come together, or it's about breaking... often about breaking a pattern which you've worked really hard to establish. I'm trying to think. If you think of Rondo alla Turca, Mozart, you know, this piece of music, it continues like that. That's the rhythm for the entire sonata, and then it ends on these sort of spondees, like poetic spondees, where he breaks that pattern with dun, 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 these three things, and that's all it is. I mean, it's not really a natural ending, it's just something that informs you that you're not going to be, that pattern's over now. So that's what, for me, it's about patterns. And that's why I used the figure of the circle before, because it's when it's sort of, when it feels like it's arrived back. Never meeting up, or like a circle, is that a concentric circle that doesn't quite meet up? Yeah, it sort of passes over the same point, but it's slightly changed, and that's the ending.
And that's a good point, because I mean, there's an article about that which says that a really good short story, or any narrative, in this case it was talking more broadly, but that arriving at the end should send you back to the beginning with new questions, and I think that's so true.
There's a Les Murray poem where one of the lines in it is, "A spider walking in circles is celebrating the birthday of logic." And that stuck with me when I read it, because, yeah.
I just had a question for Luke, what you just said there. Do you think that's, I think, Julia, I've seen you talk about this previously, that can be sort of determined or cliche structure to literary short story, but its circularity is self-conscious in some way. Do you notice what that?
Yeah, of course. All of those tricks, I'll call them tricks, not pejoratively, I don't mind calling them tricks. I think once they become recognisable, then they're no longer serving their purpose, and it's about disguising them, and, you know, talking about realism earlier on today, and realism is another trick, and verisimilitude, it needs to keep advancing, but it's always just advancing to keep playing the same trick, right, to keep casting a spell over the reader. So yeah, absolutely. If it's recognisable as formulaic, then it's not going to work. It sucks. Even if it worked last time, if someone picks up on it this time, it's probably not. But you know, what are you going to do? That's good, right? That's how the story keeps evolving, because you have to invent new tricks to get around. No one will read this.
And I think that's true, isn't it? Because it brings us back to Wharton, that idea of lens, that we're seeing whatever we're seeing in terms of the detail of the story, we're seeing through a very unique and idiosyncratic specific consciousness. And then tricks don't feel like, I mean, because it becomes an individual way of seeing. So, and that's what we were talking about on that panel, that's right, about the bringing together of detail through a unique way of seeing.
Just to really say you don't like endings, I sort of wondered maybe your endings would be any less formulaic.
I think it's because there are obviously bad endings where everything gets tied up and everything works. The happy ever after ending is not much good once you sort of graduate past the age of 8. But that's just a particular kind of ending. I mean, they all end in some way, just like this panel is about to end.
Thank you. You took the words right out of my mouth.
Beautiful segue.
Perfect segue. Thank you so much. We have come to the end of this session. Please join me in thanking Luke Johnson.